shall it be read, or shall it be passed over? And shall we not regard this incident?" Monsieur de Morcerf turned pale and clenched his hands on the papers he held. The committee decided to hear the letter. The count was thoughtful and silent. The president read, "Mr. President, I can furnish the committee of inquiry into the conduct of the Lieutenant General, the Count of Morcerf, in Epirus and in Macedonia, with important particulars." The president paused, and the count turned pale. The president looked at his auditors. "Proceed," was heard on all sides. The president resumed. "I was on the spot at the death of Ali Pasha. I was present during his last moments. I know what is become of Vasiliki and Ede. I am at the command of the committee, and even claim the honor of being heard. I shall be in the lobby when this note is delivered to you." "And who is this witness, or rather this enemy?" asked the count, in a tone in which there was a visible alteration. "We shall know, sir," replied the president. "Is the committee willing to hear this witness?" "Yes, yes," said they all at once. The doorkeeper was called. "Is there anyone in the lobby?" said the president. "Yes, sir." "Who is it?" "A female, accompanied by a servant." Everyone looked at his neighbor. "Introduce the female," said the president. 5 minutes after, the doorkeeper again appeared. All eyes were fixed on the door, and I, said Beauchamp, shared the general expectation and anxiety. Behind the doorkeeper walked a female enveloped in a large veil, which completely concealed her. It was evident from her figure and the perfumes she had about her that this was a young and elegant woman. But that was all. The president requested her to throw aside her veil, and it was then seen she was dressed in the Grecian costume and was remarkably beautiful.
"Ah," said Albert, "it was she."
"Who?"
"Ede."
"Who told you that?"
"Alas, I guess it. But go on, Beauchamp. You see, I am calm and strong, and yet we must be drawing near the disclosure."
"Monsieur de Morcerf," continued Beauchamp, "looked at this female with surprise and terror. Her lips were about to pass his sentence of life or death. To all the committee, the adventure was so extraordinary and curious that the interest they had felt for the Count's safety became now quite a secondary matter. The president himself advanced to place a seat for the young lady, but she declined availing herself of it. As for the Count, he had fallen on his chair. It was evident his legs refused to support him. "Madame," said the president, "you have engaged to furnish the committee with some important particulars respecting the affair at Janina, and you have stated that you were an eyewitness of the events." "I was indeed," said the stranger, with a tone of sweet melancholy, and with the sonorous voice peculiar to the East. "But allow me to say, you must have been very young then." "I was 4 years old, but as those events deeply concerned me, not a single particular has escaped my memory." "In what manner could these events concern you, and who are you, that they should have made so deep an impression on you?" "On them depended my father's life," replied she. "I am Ede, the daughter of Ali Tebalan, Pasha of Janina, and of Vasiliki, his beloved wife." The blush of mingled pride and modesty which suddenly suffused the cheeks of the young female, the brilliancy of her eye, and her highly important communication produced an inexpressible effect on the assembly. As for the Count, he could not have been more overwhelmed if a thunderbolt had fallen at his feet and opened before him an immense gulf.
"Madame," replied the President, bowing with profound respect, "allow me to ask one question. It shall be the last. Can you prove the authenticity of what you have now stated?"
"I can, sir," said Adey, drawing from under her veil a satin satchel highly perfumed. "For here is the register of my birth, signed by my father and his principal officers, and that of my baptism, my father having consented to my being brought up in my mother's faith. This latter has been sealed by the Grand Primate of Macedonia and Epirus. And lastly, and perhaps the most important, the record of the sale of my person and that of my mother to the Armenian merchant El Kobir by the French officer who, in his infamous bargain with the Porte, had reserved his part of the booty, the wife and daughter of his benefactor, whom he sold for the sum of 400,000 francs. A greenish paleness spread over the Count's cheeks, and his eyes became bloodshot at these terrible imputations, which were listened to by the assembly with an ill-foreboding silence. Adey, still calm, but whose calmness was more dreadful than the anger of another would have been, handed to the President the record of her sale, registered in Arabic. It had been supposed some of these papers might be registered in the Arabian, Romaic, or Turkish language, and the interpreter of the house was in attendance. One of the noble peers, who was familiar with the Arabian language, having studied it during the Sublime Egyptian campaign, followed with his eye as the translator read aloud, "I, El Kobir, a slave merchant and furnisher of the harem of His Highness, acknowledge having received for transmission to the Sublime Emperor from the French Lord, Count of Monte Cristo, an emerald valued at 800,000 francs as the ransom of a young Christian slave of 11 years of age named Adey, the acknowledged daughter of the late Lord Ali Tebelin, Pasha of Yanina, and of Vasiliki, his favourite, she having been sold to me 7 years previously with her mother, who had died on arriving at Constantinople by a French colonel in the service of the vizier Ali Tebelin, named Fernand Mondego. The above-mentioned purchase was made on His Highness's account, whose mandate I had, for the sum of 400,000 francs. Given at Constantinople by authority of His Highness in the year 1247 of the Hegira, signed El Kobir. That this record should have all due authority, it shall bear the imperial seal, which the vendor is bound to have affixed to it." Near the merchant's signature there was, indeed, the seal of the Sublime Emperor. A dreadful silence succeeded the reading of this paper. The Count could only look, and his gaze, fixed as if unconsciously on Adey, seemed one of fire and blood. "Madame," said the President, "may reference be made to the Count of Monte Cristo, who is now, I believe, in Paris?" "Sir," replied Adey, "the Count of Monte Cristo, my foster father, has been in Normandy the last 3 days. Who, then, has counseled you to take this step, one for which the court is deeply indebted to you, and which is perfectly natural considering your birth and your misfortunes?" "Sir," replied Adey, "I have been led to take this step from a feeling of respect and grief. Although a Christian, may God forgive me, I have always sought to revenge my illustrious father. Since I set my foot in France and knew the traitor lived in Paris, I have watched carefully. I live retired in the house of my noble protector, but I do it from choice. I love retirement and silence because I can live with my thoughts and recollections of past days.
but Monsieur le Comte de Monte Cristo surrounds me with every paternal care, and I am ignorant of nothing which passes in the world. I learn all in the silence of my apartments. For instance, I see all the newspapers, every periodical, as well as every new melody, and by thus watching the course of the life of others, I learned what has transpired this morning in the House of Peers, and what was to take place this evening. Then I wrote. Then, remarked the President, the Count of Monte Cristo knows nothing of your present proceedings. He is quite unaware of them, and I have but one fear, which is that he should disapprove of what I have done. But it is a glorious day for me, continued the young girl, raising her ardent gaze to heaven, that on which I find at last an opportunity of revenging my father. The Count had not uttered one word the whole of this time. His colleagues looked at him and doubtless pitied his blighted prospects, which sank under the perfumed breath of a woman. His misery was depicted by sinister lines on his countenance. "Monsieur de Morcerf," said the President, "do you recognize this lady as the daughter of Ali Tebelin, Pasha of Yanina?" "No," said Morcerf, attempting to rise. "It is a base plot contrived by my enemies." Haydée, whose eyes had been fixed upon the door as if expecting someone, turned hastily, and seeing the Count standing, shrieked. "You do not know me?" said she. "Well, I fortunately recognize you. You are Fernand Mondego, the French officer who led the troops of my noble father. It is you who surrendered the castle of Yanina. It is you who, sent by him to Constantinople to treat with the emperor of the life or death of your benefactor, brought back a false mandate granting full pardon. It is you who, with that mandate, obtained the Pasha's ring, which gave you authority over Selim, the firekeeper. It is you who stabbed Selim. It is you who sold us, my mother and me, to the merchant El Kobia. Assassin, 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 you have still on your brow your master's blood. Look, gentlemen, all." These words had been pronounced with such enthusiasm and evident truth that every eye was fixed on the Count's forehead, and he himself passed his hand across it, as if he felt Ali's blood still moist upon it. "You positively recognize Monsieur de Morcerf as the officer Fernand Mondego?" "Indeed I do," cried Haydée. "Oh, my mother, it was you who told me. You were free. You had a beloved father. You were destined to be almost a queen. Look well at that man. It is he who raised your father's head on the point of a spear. It is he who sold us. It is he who forsook us. Look well at his right hand, on which he has a large wound. If you forgot his features, you would know him by that hand, into which fell one by one the golden pieces of the merchant El Kobia. I know him. Ah, let him say now if he does not recognize me." Each word fell like a dagger on Morcerf, and deprived him of a portion of his energy. As she uttered the last, he hid hastily in his bosom his hand, which had indeed been mutilated by a wound, and fell back on his chair, overwhelmed by wretchedness and despair. This scene completely changed the opinion of the assembly respecting the accused Count. "Monsieur le Comte de Morcerf," said the President, "do not allow yourself to be depressed. Answer. The justice of the court is supreme and impartial as that of God.
It will not suffer you to be trampled on by your enemies without giving you an opportunity of defending yourself. Shall further inquiries be made? Shall two members of the house be sent to Yanina? Speak. Morcerf did not reply. Then all the members looked at each other with terror. They knew the Count's energetic and violent temper. It must be indeed a dreadful blow which would deprive him of courage to defend himself. They expected this silence, resembling a sleep, would be followed by an awakening like a thunderbolt. "Well," asked the President, "what is your decision?" "I have no reply to make," said the Count in a low tone. "Has the daughter of Ali Tebelin spoken the truth?" said the President. "Is she then the terrible witness to whose charge you dare not plead, not guilty? Have you really committed the crimes of which you are accused?" The Count looked round him with an expression which might have softened tigers, but which could not disarm his judges. Then he raised his eyes towards the ceiling, but withdrew them immediately, as if he feared the roof would open and reveal to his distressed view that second tribunal called Heaven, and that other judge named God. Then, with a hasty movement, he tore open his coat, which seemed to stifle him, and flew from the room like a madman. His footstep was heard one moment in the corridor, then the rattling of his carriage wheels as he was driven rapidly away. "Gentlemen," said the President, when silence was restored, "is Monsieur le Comte de Morcerf convicted of felony, treason, and outrage?" "Yes," replied all the members of the Committee of Inquiry, with a unanimous voice. Haydée had remained until the close of the meeting. She heard the Count's sentence pronounced without betraying an expression of joy or pity. Then, drawing her veil over her face, she bowed majestically to the councillors, and left with that dignified step which Virgil attributes to his goddesses.
This book is continued on Disc 4.
The Count of Monte Cristo by Alexandre Dumas.
Disc 4.
88. The Challenge.
"Then," continued Beauchamp, "I took advantage of the silence and the darkness to leave the house without being seen. The doorkeeper who had introduced me was waiting for me at the door, and he conducted me through the corridors to a private entrance opening into La Rue de Vaugirard. I left with mingled feelings of sorrow and delight. Excuse me, Albert, sorrow on your account, and delighted with that noble girl thus pursuing paternal vengeance. Yes, Albert. From whatever source the blow may have proceeded, it may be from an enemy, but that enemy is only the agent of Providence."
Albert held his head between his hands. He raised his face red with shame and bathed in tears, and seizing Beauchamp's arm, "My friend," said he, "my life is ended. I cannot calmly say with you, Providence has struck the blow, but I must discover who pursues me with his hatred, and when I have found him I will kill him, or he will kill me. I rely on your friendship to assist me, Beauchamp, if contempt has not banished it from your heart."
"Contempt, my friend? How does this misfortune affect you? No, happily, that unjust prejudice is forgotten which made the son responsible for the father's actions. Review your life, Albert. Although it is only just beginning, did a lovely summer's day ever dawn with greater purity than has marked the commencement of your career? No, Albert, take my advice. You are young and rich. Leave Paris. All is soon forgotten in the great Babylon of excited life and changing taste. You will return after 3 or 4 years with a Russian princess for a bride, and no one will think more of what occurred yesterday than if it had happened 16 years ago.
Thank you, my dear Beauchamp. Thank you for the excellent feeling which prompts your advice. But it cannot be thus. I have told you my wish, or, if it must be so, I will say determination. You understand that, interested as I am in this affair, I cannot see it in the same light as you do. What appears to you to emanate from a celestial source seems to me to proceed from one far less pure. Providence appears to me to have no share in this affair, and happily so, for instead of the invisible, impalpable agent of celestial rewards and punishments, I shall find one both palpable and visible, on whom I shall revenge myself, I assure you, for all I have suffered during the last month. Now, I repeat, Beauchamp, I wish to return to human and material existence, and if you are still the friend you profess to be, help me to discover the hand that struck the blow.
Be it so, said Beauchamp. If you must have me descend to earth, I submit. And if you will seek your enemy, I will assist you, and I will engage to find him, my honor being almost as deeply interested as yours.
Well, then, you understand, Beauchamp, that we begin our research immediately. Each moment's delay is an eternity for me. The calumniator is not yet punished, and he may hope he will not be. But, on my honor, if he thinks so, he deceives himself.
Well, listen, Morcerf.
Ah, Beauchamp, I see you know something already. You will restore me to life.
I do not say there is any truth in what I am going to tell you, but it is at least as a light in the dark night. By following it, we may, perhaps, discover something more certain.
Tell me, satisfy my impatience.
Well, I will tell you what I did not like to mention on my return from Yanina.
Say on.
I went, of course, to the chief banker of the town to make inquiries. At the first word, before I had even mentioned your father's name, "Ah," said he, "I guess what brings you here."
"How and why?"
"Because a fortnight since I was questioned on the same subject."
"By whom?"
"By a banker of Paris, my correspondent, whose name is Danglars."
"He?" cried Albert. "Yes, it is indeed he who has so long pursued my father with jealous hatred. He, the man who would be popular, cannot forgive the Count of Morcerf for being created a peer, and this marriage broken off without a reason being assigned. Yes, it is all from the same cause.
Inquire, Albert, but do not be angry without reason. Inquire, and if it is true—"
"Oh, yes, if it is true," cried the young man, "he shall pay me all I have suffered."
"Beware, Morcerf, he is already an old man.
I will respect his age, as he has respected the honor of my family. If my father had offended him, why did he not attack him personally? Oh, no, he was afraid to encounter him face to face."
"I do not condemn you, Albert. I only restrain you. Act prudently."
"Oh, do not fear. Besides, you will accompany me. Beauchamp, solemn transactions should be sanctioned by a witness. Before this day closes, if Monsieur Danglars is guilty, he shall cease to live, or I will die."
"When such resolutions are made, Albert, they should be promptly executed. Do you wish to go to Monsieur Danglars? Let us go immediately."
They sent for a cabriolet. On entering the banker's mansion, they perceived the phaeton and servant of Monsieur Andrea Cavalcanti.
"Ah, parbleu, that's good," said Albert, with a gloomy tone. "If Monsieur Danglars will not fight with me, I will kill his son-in-law. Cavalcanti will certainly fight."
The servant announced the young man, but the banker, recollecting what had transpired the day before, did not wish him admitted. It was, however, too late. Albert had followed the footman, and hearing the order given, forced the door open, and followed by Beauchamp, found himself in the banker's cabinet.
"Sir," cried the latter, "am I no longer at liberty to receive whom I choose in my house? You appear to forget yourself, sadly."
"No, sir," said Albert coldly. "There are circumstances in which one cannot accept through cowardice. I offer you that refuge. Refuse to admit certain persons, at least."
"What is your errand, then, with me, sir?"
"I mean," said Albert, approaching without apparently noticing Cavalcanti, who stood with his back towards the fireplace, "I mean to propose a meeting in some retired corner, where two men, having met, one of them will remain on the ground." Danglars turned pale. Cavalcanti moved a step forward, and Albert turned towards him. "And you too," said he. "Come, if you like, Monsieur le Comte. You have a claim, being almost one of the family, and I will give as many rendezvous of that kind as I can find persons willing to accept them." Cavalcanti looked at Danglars with a stupefied air, and the latter, making an effort, rose and advanced between the two young people. Albert's attack on Andrea had placed him on a different footing, and he hoped this visit had another cause than that he had at first supposed.
"Indeed, sir," said he to Albert, "if you are come to quarrel with this gentleman because I have preferred him to you, I shall resign the case to the Procureur du Roi."
"You mistake, sir," said Morcerf with a gloomy smile. "I am not alluding in the least to matrimony, and I only address myself to Monsieur Cavalcanti because he appeared disposed to interfere between us. In one respect you are right, for I am ready to quarrel with everyone today. But you have the first claim, Monsieur Danglars."
"Sir," replied Danglars, pale with anger and fear, "I warn you, when I have the misfortune to meet with a mad dog, I kill it, and far from thinking myself guilty of a crime, I believe I do society a kindness. Now, if you are mad and try to bite me, I will kill you without pity. Is it my fault that your father has dishonored himself, you miserable wretch?" cried Morcerf. "It is your fault."
Danglars retreated a few steps.
"Who wrote to Yanina?" "To Yanina? Yes. Who wrote for particulars concerning my father?" "I imagine anyone may write to Yanina, but one person only wrote, and that was you. I doubtless wrote. It appears to me that when about to marry your daughter to a young man, it is right to make some inquiries respecting his family. It is not only a right, but a duty. You wrote, sir, knowing what answer you would receive." "I, indeed? I assure you," cried Danglars, with a confidence and security proceeding less from fear than from the interest he really felt for the young man, "I solemnly declare to you that I should never have thought of writing to Yanina did I know anything of Ali Pasha's misfortunes." "Who, then, urged you to write?" "Tell me." "Pardieu, it was the most simple thing in the world. I was speaking of your father's past history. I said the origin of his fortune remained obscure. The person to whom I addressed my scruples asked me where your father had acquired his property. I answered, 'In Greece.' 'Then,' said he, 'write to Yanina.'"
"And who thus advised you?"
"No other than your friend, Monte Cristo."
"The Count of Monte Cristo told you to write to Yanina?"
"Yes, and I wrote, and will show you my correspondence if you like."
Albert and Beauchamp looked at each other.
"Sir," said Beauchamp, who had not yet spoken, "you appear to accuse the Count, who is absent from Paris at this moment and cannot justify himself." "I accuse no one, sir," said Danglars. "I relate, and I will repeat before the Count what I have said to you."
"Does the Count know what answer you received?"
"Yes.
I showed it to him. Did he know my father's Christian name was Fernand and his family name Mondego? Yes. I had told him that long since, and I did nothing more than any other would have done in my circumstances, and perhaps less. When, the day after the arrival of this answer, your father came, by the advice of Monte Cristo, to ask my daughter's hand for you, I decidedly refused him, but without any explanation or exposure. In short, why should I have any more to do with the affair? How did the honor or disgrace of Monsieur de Morcerf affect me? It neither increased or decreased my income.
Albert felt the color mounting to his brow. There was no doubt upon the subject. Danglars defended himself with the baseness, but at the same time with the assurance of a man who speaks the truth at least in part, if not wholly, not for conscience' sake, but through fear. Besides, what was Morcerf seeking? It was not whether Danglars or Monte Cristo was more or less guilty. It was a man who would answer for the offence, whether trifling or serious. It was a man who would fight, and it was evident Danglars would not fight. And, in addition to this, everything forgotten or unperceived before presented itself now to his recollection. Monte Cristo knew everything, as he had bought the daughter of Ali Pasha, and, knowing everything, he had advised Danglars to write to Yanina. The answer known, he had yielded to Albert's wish to be introduced to Ade, and allowed the conversation to turn on the death of Ali, and had not opposed Ade's recital, but having doubtless warned the young girl, in the few Romaic words he spoke to her, not to discover Morcerf's father. Besides, had he not begged of Morcerf not to mention his father's name before Ade? Lastly, he had taken Albert to Normandy when he knew the final blow approached. There could be no doubt that all had been calculated and previously arranged. Monte Cristo then was in league with his father's enemies. Albert took Beauchamp aside and communicated these ideas to him.
"You are right," said the latter. "Monsieur Danglars has only been a secondary agent in this sad affair, and it is of Monsieur de Monte Cristo that you must demand an explanation."
Albert turned. "Sir," said he to Danglars, "understand that I do not take a final leave of you. I must ascertain if your insinuations are just, and am going now to inquire of the Count of Monte Cristo." He bowed to the banker and went out with Beauchamp without appearing to notice Cavalcanti. Danglars accompanied him to the door, where he again assured Albert no motive of personal hatred influenced him against the Count de Morcerf. 89. The Insult. At the banker's door, Beauchamp stopped Morcerf.
"Listen," said he. "Just now I told you it was of Monsieur de Monte Cristo you must demand an explanation."
"Yes, and we are going to his house."
"Reflect, Morcerf, one moment before you go." "On what shall I reflect?" "On the importance of the step you are taking."
"Is it more serious than going to Monsieur Danglars?"
"Yes. Monsieur Danglars is a money lover, and those who love money, you know, think too much of what they risk to be easily induced to fight a duel. The other is, on the contrary, to all appearance, a true nobleman. But do you not fear to find in him the bravo?"
"I only fear one thing, namely to find a man who will not fight."
"Do not be alarmed," said Beauchamp. "He will meet you. My only fear is that he will be too strong for you."
"My friend," said Morcerf with a sweet smile, "that is what I wish. The happiest thing that could occur to me would be to die in my father's stead. That would save us all."
"Your mother would die of grief."
"My poor mother," said Albert, passing his hand across his eyes. "I know she would. But better so than die of shame."
"Are you quite decided, Albert?"
"Yes. Let us go."
They ordered the driver to take them to No. 30 Champs-Élysées. Beauchamp wished to go in alone, but Albert observed, as this was an unusual circumstance, he might be allowed to deviate from the etiquette of duels. The cause which the young man espoused was one so sacred that Beauchamp had only to comply with all his wishes. He yielded and contented himself with following Morcerf. Albert bounded from the porter's lodge to the steps. He was received by Battistin. The Count had indeed just arrived, but he was bathing and had forbidden that anyone should be admitted.
"But after his bath," asked Morcerf, "my master will go to dinner, and after dinner he will sleep an hour. Then he is going to the opera. Are you sure of it?" asked Albert. "Quite, sir. My master has ordered his horses at 8 o'clock precisely." "Very good," replied Albert. "That is all I wished to know." Then, turning towards Beauchamp, "If you have anything to attend to, Beauchamp, do it directly. If you have any appointment for this evening, defer it till tomorrow. I depend on you to accompany me to the opera, and, if you can, bring Chateau Renaud with you." Beauchamp availed himself of Albert's permission and left him, promising to call for him at 8:15. On his return home, Albert expressed his wish to France, Debray, and Morel to see them at the opera that evening. Then he went to see his mother, who, since the events of the day before, had refused to see anyone and had kept to her room. He found her in bed, overwhelmed with grief at this public humiliation. The sight of Albert produced the effect which might naturally be expected on Mercedes. She pressed her son's hand and sobbed aloud, but her tears relieved her. Albert stood one moment speechless by the side of his mother's bed. It was evident from his pale face and knit brows that his resolution to revenge himself was growing weaker. "My dear mother," said he, "do you know if Monsieur de Morcerf has any enemy?" Mercedes started. She noticed that the young man did not say, "my father." "My son," she said, "persons in the Count's situation have many secret enemies. Those who are known are not the most dangerous. I know it, and appeal to your penetration. You are of a superior mind. Nothing escapes you." "Why do you say so?" "Because, for instance, you noticed on the evening of the ball we gave, Monsieur de Monte Cristo would eat nothing in our house." Mercedes raised herself on her feverish arm. "Monsieur de Monte Cristo," she exclaimed, "and how is he connected with the question you ask me? You know, my mother, Monsieur de Monte Cristo is almost an Oriental, and it is customary with them to secure full liberty of revenge by not eating or drinking in the house of their enemies. Do you say Monsieur de Monte Cristo is our enemy?" replied Mercedes, becoming paler than the sheet which covered her. "Who told you so? Why, you are mad, Albert. Monsieur de Monte Cristo has only shown us kindness. Monsieur de Monte Cristo saved your life. You yourself presented him to us. Oh, I entreat you, my son, if you had entertained such an idea, dispel it. And my counsel to you, even more, my prayer is, retain his friendship."
"My mother," replied the young man, "you have special reasons for telling me to conciliate that man."
"I?"
said Mercedes, blushing as rapidly as she had turned pale, and again becoming paler than ever. "Yes, doubtless. And is it not because he can never do us any harm?" Mercedes shuddered, and fixing on her son a scrutinizing gaze,
"You speak strangely," said she to Albert, "and you appear to have some singular prejudices. What has the Count done? 3 days since you were with him in Normandy. Only 3 days since we looked on him as our best friend."
An ironical smile passed over Albert's lips. Mercedes saw it, and with her double instinct of a woman and a mother, she guessed all. But, prudent and strong-minded, she concealed both her sorrows and her fears. Albert was silent. An instant after, the Countess resumed.
"You came to inquire after my health. I will candidly acknowledge I am not well. You should install yourself here and cheer my solitude. I do not wish to be left alone."
"My mother," said the young man, "you know how gladly I would obey your wish,
but an urgent and important affair obliges me to leave you the whole evening."
"Well," replied Mercedes, sighing, "go, Albert. I will not make you a slave to your filial piety."
Scarcely had he shut her door than Mercedes called a confidential servant and ordered him to follow Albert wherever he should go that evening and to come and tell her immediately what he observed. Then she rang for her lady's maid, and, weak as she was, she dressed in order to be ready for whatever might happen. The footman's mission was an easy one. Albert went to his room and dressed with unusual care. At 8:10, Beauchamp arrived. He had seen Chateau Renaud, who had promised to be in the orchestra before the curtain was raised. Both got into Albert's coupe, who, having no reason to conceal where he was going, called aloud, "To the opera." In his impatience, he had arrived before the commencement of the performance. Chateau Renaud was at his post. Apprised by Beauchamp of the circumstances, he required no explanation from Albert. The conduct of this son, seeking to avenge his father, was so natural that Chateau Renaud did not seek to dissuade him, and was content with renewing his assurances of devotedness to Albert. Debray was not yet come, but Albert knew he seldom lost a scene at the opera. Albert wandered about the theatre until the curtain was drawn up. He hoped to meet with Monsieur de Monte Cristo either in the lobby or on the stairs. The bell summoned him to his seat, and he entered the orchestra with Chateau Renaud and Beauchamp, but his eyes scarcely quitted the box between the columns, which remained obstinately closed during the whole of the first act. At last, as Albert was looking at his watch about the 100th time, at the commencement of the second act, the door opened and Monte Cristo, dressed in black, entered, and leaning over the front of the box, looked round the pit. Morel followed him and looked also for his sister and brother-in-law. He soon discovered them in another box and kissed his hand to them. The Count, in his survey of the pit, encountered a pale face and threatening eyes, which evidently sought to gain his attention. He recognized Albert, but thought it better not to notice him, as he looked so angry and discomposed. Without communicating his thoughts to his companion, he sat down, drew out his opera-glass, and looked another way. Although apparently not noticing Albert, he did not, however, lose sight of him, and when the curtain fell at the end of the second act, he saw him leave the orchestra with his two friends. Then his head was seen passing at the back of the boxes, and the Count knew the approaching storm was intended to fall on him. He was, at the moment, conversing cheerfully with Morel, but he was well prepared for what might happen. The door opened, and Monte Cristo, turning round, saw Albert, pale and trembling, followed by Beauchamp and Chateau Renaud. "Well," cried he, with that benevolent politeness which distinguished his salutation from the common civilities of the world, "my cavalier has attained his object. Good evening, Monsieur de Morcerf." The countenance of this man, who possessed such extraordinary control over his feelings, expressed the most perfect cordiality. Morel only then recollected the letter he had received from the Viscount, in which, without assigning any reason, he begged him to go to the opera, but he understood that something terrible was brooding.
"We are not come here, sir, to exchange hypocritical expressions of politeness or false professions of friendship," said Albert, "but to demand an explanation, Count."
The trembling voice of the young man was scarcely audible. "An explanation at the opera?" said the Count, with that calm tone and penetrating eye which characterizes the man who knows his cause is good. "Little acquainted as I am with the habits of Parisians, I should not have thought this the place for such a demand. Still, if people will shut themselves up," said Albert, "and cannot be seen because they are bathing, dining, or asleep, we must avail ourselves of the opportunity whenever they are to be seen. I am not difficult of access, sir, for yesterday, if my memory does not deceive me, you were at my house. Yesterday, I was at your house, sir," said the young man, "because then I knew not who you were."
In pronouncing these words, Albert had raised his voice so as to be heard by those in the adjoining boxes and in the lobby. Thus the attention of many was attracted by this altercation. "Where are you come from, sir? You do not appear to be in the possession of your senses, provided I understand your perfidy, sir, and succeed in making you understand that I will be revenged. I shall be reasonable enough," said Albert furiously. "I do not understand you, sir," replied Monte Cristo, "and if I did, your tone is too high. I am at home here, and I alone have a right to raise my voice above another's. Leave the box, sir." Monte Cristo pointed towards the door with the most commanding dignity. "Ah, I shall know how to make you leave your home," replied Albert, clasping in his convulsed grasp the glove which Monte Cristo did not lose sight of. "Well, well," said Monte Cristo quietly, "I see you wish to quarrel with me, but I would give you one counsel, and do not forget it. It is a bad habit to make a display of a challenge. Display is not becoming to everyone, Monsieur de Morcerf." At this name, a murmur of astonishment passed round the group of spectators of this scene. They had talked of no one but Morcerf the whole day. Albert understood the allusion in a moment, and was about to throw his glove at the Count, when Morel seized his hand, while Beauchamp and Château Renaud, fearing the scene would surpass the limits of a challenge, held him back. But Monte Cristo, without rising and leaning forward in his chair, merely extended his hand and, taking the damp, crushed glove from the clenched hand of the young man, "Sir," said he in a solemn tone, "I consider your glove thrown, and will return it you round a bullet. Now leave me, or I will summon my servants to throw you out at the door." Wild, almost unconscious, and with eyes inflamed, Albert stepped back, and Morel closed the door. Monte Cristo took up his glass again, as if nothing had happened. He certainly must have had a heart of brass and face of marble. Morel whispered, "What have you done to him?" "I? Nothing, at least personally," said Monte Cristo. "But there must be some cause for this strange scene. The Comte de Morcerf's adventure exasperates the young man. Have you anything to do with it?" "It was by Aidey. The house was informed of his father's treason." "Indeed," said Morel. "I had been told, but would not credit it, that the Grecian slave I have seen with you here in this very box was the daughter of Ali Pasha." "It is, notwithstanding, true." "Then," said Morel, "I understand it all, and this scene was premeditated." "How so?" "Yes. Albert wrote to request me to come to the opera, doubtless that I might be a witness of the insult he meant to offer you." "Probably," said Monte Cristo, with his imperturbable tranquillity. "But what will you do with him?" "As certainly, Maximilian, as I now press your hand, I will kill him before 10 o'clock tomorrow morning." Morel, in his turn, took Monte Cristo's hand in both of his, and he shuddered to feel how cold and steady it was. "Ah, Count," said he, "his father loves him so much." "Do not speak to me of that," said Monte Cristo, with the first movement of anger he had betrayed. "I will make him suffer." Morel, amazed, let fall Monte Cristo's hand. "Count, Count," said he. "Dear Maximilian," interrupted the Count, "listen how adorably Dupré is singing that line. I was the first to discover Dupré at Naples, and the first to applaud him. Bravo! Bravo!" Morel saw it was useless to say more, and refrained. The curtain, which had been drawn up during the scene with Albert, again fell, and a rap was heard at the door. "Come in," said Monte Cristo, without his voice betraying the least emotion, and immediately Beauchamp appeared. "Good evening, Monsieur Beauchamp," said Monte Cristo, as if this was the first time he had seen the journalist that evening. "Take a seat." Beauchamp bowed, and sitting down,
sir, said he, I just now accompanied Monsieur de Morcerf, as you saw.
And that means, replied Monte Cristo, laughing, that you had probably just dined together. I am happy to see, Monsieur Beauchamp, you are more sober than he was.
Sir, said Beauchamp, Albert was wrong, I acknowledge, to betray so much anger, and I come on my own account to apologize for him. And having done so, on my own account only, you understand, Monsieur Lecomte, I would add that I believe you too gentlemanly to refuse giving him some explanation concerning your connection with Yanina. Then I will add two words about the young Greek girl.
Monte Cristo motioned to him to be silent.
Come, said he, laughing, there are all my hopes about to be destroyed.
How so? Asked Beauchamp. Doubtless you wish to make me appear a very eccentric character. I am, in your opinion, a Lara, a Manfred, a Lord Ruthven. Then, just as I am arriving at the climax, you defeat your own end and seek to make a common man of me. You bring me down to your own level and demand explanations. Indeed, Monsieur Beauchamp, it is quite laughable.
Yet, replied Beauchamp haughtily, there are occasions when probity commands.
Monsieur Beauchamp, interrupted this strange man, the Count of Monte Cristo bows to none but the Count of Monte Cristo himself. Say no more, I entreat you. I do what I please, Monsieur Beauchamp, and it is always well done.
Sir, replied the young man, honest men are not to be paid with such coin. I require honorable guarantees.
I am, sir, a living guarantee, replied Monte Cristo, motionless but with a threatening look. We have both blood in our veins which we wish to shed. That is our mutual guarantee. Tell the Viscount so, and that tomorrow, before 10 o'clock, I shall see what color his is.
Then I have only to make arrangements for the duel, said Beauchamp.
It is quite immaterial to me, said Monte Cristo, and it was very unnecessary to disturb me at the opera for such a trifle. In France, people fight with the sword or pistol, in the colonies with the carbine, in Arabia with the dagger. Tell your client that although I am the insulted party, in order to carry out my eccentricity, I leave him the choice of arms, and will accept without discussion, without dispute, anything, even combat by drawing lots, which is always stupid, but with me different from other people, as I am sure to gain.
Sure to gain? Repeated Beauchamp, looking with amazement at the Count.
Certainly, said Monte Cristo, slightly shrugging up his shoulders. Otherwise I would not fight with Monsieur de Morcerf. I shall kill him. I cannot help it. Only by a single line this evening at my house. Let me know the arms and the hour. I do not like to be kept waiting.
Pistols, then, at 8 o'clock in the Bois de Vincennes, said Beauchamp, quite disconcerted, not knowing if he was dealing with an arrogant braggadocio or a supernatural being.
Very well, sir, said Monte Cristo. Now all that is settled, do let me see the performance, and tell your friend Albert not to come any more this evening. He will hurt himself with all his ill-chosen barbarisms. Let him go home and go to sleep.
Beauchamp left the box, perfectly amazed.
Now, said Monte Cristo, turning towards Morel, I may depend upon you, may I not?
Certainly, said Morel. I am at your service, Count.
Still,
what?
It is desirable I should know the real cause. That is to say, you would rather not.
No.
The young man himself is acting blindfolded, and knows not the true cause which is known only to God and to me. But I give you my word, Morel, that God, who does know it, will be on our side.
Enough, said Morel. Who is your second witness?
I know no one in Paris, Morel, on whom I could confer that honour, besides you and your brother, Emmanuel. Do you think Emmanuel would oblige me? I will answer for him, Count. Well, that is all I require. Tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock you will be with me, will you not? We will. Hush, the curtain is rising. Listen, I never lose a note of this opera if I can avoid it. The music of William Tell is so sweet.
90. Mercedes. Monsieur de Monte Cristo waited, according to his usual custom, until Dupré had sung his famous Suivez-moi. Then he rose and went out. Morel took leave of him at the door, renewing his promise to be with him the next morning at 7 o'clock, and to bring Emmanuel with him. Then he stepped into his coupé, calm and smiling, and was at home in 5 minutes. No one who knew the Count could mistake his expression when, on entering, he said, "Ali, bring me my pistols with an ivory cross." Ali brought the box to his master, who examined his arms with a solicitude very natural to a man who is about to entrust his life to a little powder and shot. These were particular pistols which Monte Cristo had had made to shoot at a target in his room. A cap was sufficient to drive out the ball, and from the adjoining room no one would have suspected the Count was, as sportsmen would say, keeping his hand in. He was just taking one in his hand and looking for the point to aim at on a little iron plate which served him as a target, when his cabinet door opened and Batista entered. Before he had spoken a word, the Count perceived in the next room a veiled female, who had followed closely after Batista, and now, seeing the Count with a pistol in his hand and swords on the table, rushed in. Batista looked at his master, who made a sign to him, and he went out, closing the door after him. "Who are you, madame?" said the Count to the veiled female. The stranger cast one look around her, to be certain they were quite alone. Then, bending, as if she would have knelt, and joining her hands, she said with an accent of despair, "Edmund, you will not kill my son." The Count retreated a step, uttered a slight exclamation, and let fall the pistol he held. "What name did you pronounce them, Madame de Morcerf?" said he. "Yours," cried she, throwing back her veil. "Yours, which I alone, perhaps, have not forgotten. Edmund, it is not Madame de Morcerf who has come to you. It is Mercedes."
"Mercedes is dead, madame," said Monte Cristo. "I know no one now of that name."
"Mercedes lives, sir, and she remembers, for she alone recognized you when she saw you, and even before she saw you, by your voice, Edmund, by the simple sound of your voice. And from that moment she has followed your steps, watched you, feared you, and she needs not to inquire what hand has dealt the blow which now strikes Monsieur de Morcerf."
"Fernand, do you mean?" replied Monte Cristo with bitter irony. "Since we are recalling names, let us remember them all." Monte Cristo had pronounced the name of Fernand with such an expression of hatred that Mercedes felt a thrill of terror run through every vein.
"You see, Edmund, I am not mistaken, and have cause to say, spare my son."
"And who told you, madame, I have any hostile intentions against your son?"
"No one, in truth. But a mother has a twofold sight. I guessed it all. I followed him this evening to the opera, and have seen all."
"If you have seen all, madame, you know that the son of Fernand has publicly insulted me," said Monte Cristo with awful calmness.
"Oh, for pity's sake."
"You have seen that he would have thrown his glove in my face if Morel, one of my friends, had not stopped him."
"Listen to me. My son has also guessed who you are. He attributes his father's misfortunes to you."
"Madame, you are mistaken. They are not misfortunes. It is a punishment. It is not I who strike Monsieur de Morcerf. It is Providence which punishes him."
"And why do you represent Providence?"
cried Mercedes. "Why do you remember when it forgets? What are Janina and its vizier to you, Edmund? What injury has Fernand Mondego done you in betraying Ali Tebelin?"
"And, madame," replied Monte Cristo, "all this is an affair between the French captain and the daughter of Vasiliki. It does not concern me, you are right. And if I have sworn to revenge myself, it is not on the French captain, nor on the Count de Morcerf, but on the fisherman Fernand.